Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
720 WGN, a pleasant Halloween evening on this Thursday night, Extension 720. Normally you'd hear Mr. Justin Kaufman, but John Hansen here filling in this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. Kind of a dreary, snowy, slushy ride out there. Looks like, as you heard David say, a lot of the stuff is out of the way for now. Oh boy, certainly made a mess of things over the day today. I want to hear from everyone out there and start this conversation about trick-or-treating. I want to know, did kids trick-or-treat through this stuff? 312-981-7200. Give us the report from your neck of the woods, wherever that may be, whether you're in the city, the suburbs, rural parts, all over the Midwest. I want to know, first, were the kids trick-or-treating through the mess? And two, what were the popular costumes that you saw rolling on through? I want to know what the kids are wearing. I know a lot of, I saw a couple of them and posted on photos here too. I think a popular one in the city this year is Chance the Snapper and Alligator Rob. I think that makes sense. Or Alligator Bob, the one that was unsuccessful. I saw someone do both, where mom and dad, one was Rob, one was Bob, and the kid was Chance the Snapper. In a wagon. I imagine that's popular. I don't know if politics is as popular this year, not being a presidential year, but I'm sure there's some masks around. So 312-981-7200, let us know. And if they're still trick-or-treating, hey, we'll hear from them. We'll put them on the air, sure. 312-981-7200. A good evening to Pete. Pete, are you doing on this? You're missing out on the trick-or-treating duties here tonight, obviously here with me, but yeah. I know there's a bucket out by your house.
There is.
And it's the take one, be honest bucket, right?
That's right.
Did you ever come across those when you did trick-or-treating as a kid?
I don't remember if I... No, I don't think I did. Mm. I think I was always a person.
Yes, and or that or no one, and then you just go on to the next house. Where they,
right.
I definitely remember the bucket out every now and then. You know, maybe it's that they weren't home or that they just don't want to be bothered. But that is always a tough policy for a child, I imagine, walking up to a bucket full of candy and adhering to that only one rule. I did it, though. You asked me. You put me on the spot earlier.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to see, check your credentials on your honesty.
I think I did. I can't remember taking a bunch, and I know the pressure's there, and, you know, but on a plethora, on a day when you're filled with abundance of candy, I feel like you're most honest there, knowing that just take one and leave some for the kids behind you.
I will say, though, that we do have a camera.
Oh, really?
Out.
You got
so
your nest looking
that's,
down?
Yeah, trick-or-treating in Edgewater. Mm-hmm. Come across our house.
Mm-hmm.
We have you on film.
If you see someone grabbing a handful, will you take that immediately to the police? Do they have other things you think that are more important to worry about? Maybe hunt them. Not hunt them. Find them yourselves and find their parents.
Yeah, teach them a lesson.
Yeah. Really teach them a lesson. It says, take one, kid. And, you know, it just got me thinking about trick-or-treating. We take it as such a normal thing, a normal part of who we are as, I think, Americans. I grew up in the suburbs, so it was a very big thing. We all got dressed up in Downers Grove every single year. I mean, like, when I was, as far back as I can remember, to probably about 12, 13, till it became uncool. I don't know. Maybe I did it my freshman year of high school until it became uncool. But yeah, it's just something that we did. I know not everyone grew up in a similar background. Felicia Lawrence is one of my co-hosts on The Jam weekday mornings on CW26. Never went trick-or-treating as a kid. She grew up on the South Side, just wasn't part of her family. Amy Rutledge, my other co-host, she grew up in Schaumburg, same thing, every single year, and she keeps that tradition going. But it just kind of got me thinking, like, how does this happen that one night out of the year you just have millions of children wandering the streets, going door to door asking for candy and saying a little thing, trick or treat, smell my feet, whatever it might be, and you know, because those things, you know, they happen organically over time and they evolve. But when did we get to what we know as modern day trick or treating? So I'm going to dive into this a little bit here to start, and get a little bit deeper after our first commercial break, because this goes back in time, and by the way, my first source here is Wikipedia, so take everything with whatever it might be, a grain of nerds, if you will. but usually a reliable source. So ancient precursors there existed for trick-or-treating. There's a lot of things that go back and back in time, of course. So traditional, similar to the modern custom of trick-or-treating, extend, they think, back to classical antiquity. Although it's extremely unlikely that any of them are directly related to the modern custom, the ancient Greek, one of the writers wrote in a book that in ancient times on the Greek island of Rhodes, there was a custom where children would go door to door dressed as swallows. They would sing a song which demanded the owners of the house to give them food and threatened to cause mischief if the owners of the house refused. That sounds pretty similar, but then there's this large gap in time, so they don't think that the two are connected. So since the Middle Ages, they say, there's been a tradition called mumming on certain holidays. It's existed in parts of Britain and Ireland, and that also involved going door-to-door in costume, performing short scenes, parts of a play in exchange for food or drink. The custom of trick-or-treating on Halloween may come from the belief that supernatural beings or souls of the dead roam the earth at this time, and they needed to be appeased. It may have also originated at a Celtic festival that was held around this time of year, October 31, November 1st, to kind of mark the beginning of winter. In Ireland, Scotland, and the Isle of Man, a couple other places in Britain, it was a festival that had pre-Christian roots. Going all the way back to the 9th century, the Catholic Church had All Saints Day on November 1st, that sort of thing. Among Celtic-speaking peoples, it was seen as a time when spirits or fairies and the souls of the dead would wander around. So that's kind of how it starts. That's where the roots are. But, of course, it goes through many, many different iterations. I'll get back to the roots of trick-or-treating, but let's get to Floyd. Floyd, you are in Iowa. How are the trick-or-treaters out there?
Well, they're very sparse, very few and far between. But we've had snow on the ground here, and it's very cold out now.
So
and the city people want to keep these kids off the street after dark because for their safety.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cold out. I don't know how it is here in Chicago, but here it's cold.
It's cold. It's cold and snowy. Anything that you just got this morning, we just got this afternoon and evening. So when you say sparse, how much did you buy a lot of candy? Were you hoping for a lot of it?
No, I just got off work, and I just seen these kids coming in. But I'll tell you what, these few that are out there, hardy little souls.
Yeah.
the parents are out there with them, but these are some hardcore little trick-or-treaters. Now, I heard that you're going into the history a bit.
Yeah.
I heard it had a very dark history to it, that it had... That you're talking about the origins of Celtic and such as that.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear you go into that more because I heard that, now it's going like for fun, tricks and treats.
Yeah.
But I heard that this thing started not as a funny deal. I'd like to hear you go into that. Let me hang up and let some more people get on the air.
I love that, Floyd. Thank you so much for the phone call. I love Floyd. He knows he gets his point across, gives a shout out to the Hardy kids, and then says, I want to listen on in. And yeah, we're going to dive in deeper to this Halloween and trick-or-treating tradition. Got a text from Palatine, and my subdivision had about 60 kids. That sounds like a lot. My neighbor had a bucket out, and one boy was grabbing a handful. I told him only one. He smarted back, so I told him they had a camera. He had the nerve to say, where? Yeah, I didn't think about that with the nests these days and all those cameras people are tracking by. In LaGrange, 630 chiming in, I had at least half the usual amount of kids trick-or-treating in LaGrange. That sounds pretty good for a night like this and an afternoon. Keep those texts coming on in. As far back as the 15th century, amongst Christians, there have been a custom of sharing soul cakes on what they called All Hallow Tide, which was October 31st through November 2nd. People would visit houses, take soul cakes, either as a representative of the dead or in return for praying for their souls. Now, later, people went from parish to parish at Halloween. They begged these soul cakes by singing under the windows with such verses as, souls, souls for a soul cake, pray you good mistress a soul cake. Okay, I don't know if I gave it quite the gusto it needed. They typically asked for mercy on all Christian souls for a soul cake. It was known as souling, and in recorded parts of Britain and southern Germany, Shakespeare mentions it in The Two Gentlemen of Verona. So we're starting to get there, but the wearing of costumes, that kind of changed it. They called it guising at Hallow Mass. It was recorded in Scotland in the 16th century, then parts of Britain and Ireland. So it's in the northern European country, so you can see eventually how it makes this leap into the United States. But it isn't quick. It's not right at revolutionary times. I'm sure in some small towns they carry this over. There's guising recorded in Scotland as early as 1895, too, with masquerades in disguise, carrying lanterns made out of turnips, visiting homes to be rewarded with cakes, fruit, and money. So, in the United States, I thought that this tradition went back way further, the candy or going to these houses in costume. But it's really only about 100 to 115 years old, and its roots are in Montreal and then eventually making its way towards the United States and in Chicago. And I dug up, I was telling Ro this old, old article from the Ladies' Home Journal written in 1920, article out of Chicago called What Shall We Do Halloween? We're going to get to that after the break. But before we do, let's talk to Edwin. Edwin, you're in Cary. How are the trick-or-treaters out there?
Oh, good heavens, I got a beef.
Okay.
The youngsters look forward to this every year, and the city of Cary would not cancel tonight. I mean, good heavens, I think the windshield factor out there is even more than they can take. And I had just one youngster and his dad come to the door.
Just one?
One youngster. So I got a big beef with the governing body of Cary. They could have easily scheduled that for Saturday and followed the suit of many other suburbs. Because, again, the youngsters look forward to this every year.
Yeah.
And, I mean, can you imagine just one youngster with his father and that's it?
Did you give him the whole bucket?
I was just about ready to do that, right? But now, listen, I kept the receipt, so I think I'll take the bag back to Target and get my money back.
Yeah, instead of eating it all. You know, when I don't get why they just don't make it the Saturday before so all the kids participate. Even if you have a rainy day, then maybe they can go a little earlier in the day or a little later. Or if you know the forecast is going to be this bad, move it up a day, push it back a day. I agree with you. But, you know, I know some suburbs that do similar things, but apparently not out in Cary, which, by the way, I'm going to be out there tomorrow on the morning show at Cary Grove High School.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's good news. We'll have to stop by. What time are you going to be there?
6 to 8 a.m., CW26, Edwin. You'll have to come on by and, hey, give me some candy. I'll make sure to put you on TV, okay?
Okay, great.
Thanks, Edwin. We're going to take a quick commercial break, then we're going to go back 99 years to Ladies' Journal and the first real mention of what trick-or-treating was in modern day on 720 WGN. What Shall We Do Halloween? An article back in the Ladies' Journal back to 1920, which I love digging through old, old newspapers or magazines. Half the fun is looking at the advertisements, the price of things. There's a lamp on the right side of this article. It clamps everywhere, they say. Light where you want it. It's called Adjust-O-Light. A new wonderful invention, Adjust-O-Light. A lamp that you can attach anywhere. To the bed, to the shaving mirror, to the desk or chair. Guess how much it cost, Pete? A nice new adjustable lamp that you move around back in 1920.
$4.
$5.75. You're pretty close there, Pete. Nice job. Maybe used it would be that much. But the actual article I'm talking about gives us kind of the first or second, as I look through publications in North America, look at what we know now as modern day trick-or-treating. So it's written by an author, Mae McGuire Telford, who was alive in the late 19th century until 1955. Don't know why you need to know that, but I let you know. She writes, "It is Halloween. A group of hilarious youngsters in costume, including two Charlie Chaplins, a Topsy, a gingerbread man, and an Indian." And it gets way more offensive from here with some of their costumes. We would say Native American these days. They don't, and they say a lot of worse things. So I'm going to have to do some self-editing. Noisily approach the front door of a large house. They ring the bell. And when the owner herself comes to the door, greet her in chorus with, "Not trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat, but nuts, nuts, we want nuts, 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 we want nuts." The housewife, taking her cue, tries to guess the identity of her young guests. If she's successful, they must forego the desired nuts. But if, on the other hand, she does not succeed in three trials, she must provide the triumphant youngsters with nuts laid in advance for that very purpose. So they don't get the nuts. If she guesses what you are, you don't get nuts. It's if she fails, that's how you get it. So costumes were meant to kind of represent what you are, but you had to, you know, come up with something that was a little bit harder to guess. So this Halloween game or custom, of course, has many variants, she goes on. In place of nuts, the youngsters may ask for apples or cookies or homemade candy. In any case, there must be a tacit or expressed agreement between the youngsters and their elders in order that the former may have fun planning and making their costumes, and the latter may have the necessary supplies. Half the fun is in the planning and making up the costumes. Here, the cooperation of parents is essential. The costumes must be inexpensive, not too elaborate, capable of withstanding a fairly rough treatment in the Chicago late fall. There you go. 99 years later, she was thinking of tonight. Appealing and a kind of fairly to disguise the identity of the wearer. Charlie Chaplin is one of the easiest. A small mustache, large shoes, a cane, ill-fitting clothes, several size too large, and ability to walk and swing the cane like the original are the requirements. Another easy costume, which has the virtue of concealing the wearer very effectively, is the ghost. Many boys will prefer to make up as cowboys or Indians. She then goes on to describe others and how you can make these costumes. I'm going to start, and it sounds bad, but I'm going to correct. It's Chocolate Boy, which really sounds like it's going to go in a bad direction, but they're saying that you're actually decorating someone as a chocolate figurine with white frosting on their eyes. And I didn't know where we were going in 1920. There are worse ones that we won't get to, including the next one I'm not going to read. I'm going to skip that one. You'll have to go find this article yourself to find out some of the rather offensive things that people dressed up as in the 20s. You can probably just kind of guess in your head what they are. Topsy, which I had never heard of. Pete, you hadn't either. Topsy's costume contains a combination of yellow, green, and red with a touch of purple. She is sometimes short of stockings and wears one that is white and one that is red. She likes jewelry, a big earrings, and bracelets, finger rings always add to her appearance. She wears short pigtails. The more, the better. These are made by dividing the hair into many parts. I didn't know we had to tell people what pigtails were back then. Braiding each part, then wrapping each braid with a small wire so it can be made to stand at any desired angle. I see, so they're kind of pointing out all over the place. Each pigtail should be tied with a white rag. The desired face can say, oh, then it gets offensive. I was just going to say, then it goes into blackface, which is horrendous. Gosh, I thought that one was okay. I should have read the whole thing. Anyways, clown, that's, we know that one. And then here's one that's interesting. Tramp. Producing the tramp effect is artistically is more difficult than might be imagined. So far as the costume is concerned, old clothes that do not fit will serve. A ragged wig is desirable but not essential, while a small derby hat crushed or with holes in it is good. The unshaven effect can be managed by means of hair and a little spirit gum. So they're just making, and they want little boys to wear, to look like a tramp, they say, with an old wig. Anyways, they also go over decorations for parties. There's more offensive things in there than this modern day age. But for Halloween parties of any kind, the decorations are important. The need may be met by the elaborate use of autumn leaves, corn stalks, pumpkin lanterns, and paper decorations. Some of the latter may be purchased at slight expense in the form of snakes, skeletons, and skulls. Large places like gymnasiums, barns, and clubhouses can be transformed into miniature woods by covering the floor to a depth of 6 to 8 inches with leaves. 6 to 8 inches of a whole gymnasium. Oh, they really went all out on these things. Small colored lights interspersed in the leaves overhead produce a delightful woodsy effect. Probably a terrible fire hazard, too. All contribute to a spooky effect when skillfully used. Crepe paper, centerpieces for the dining room table may even carry the Halloween effect and the serving of refreshments. So, that everybody who attends a Halloween party shall be in mass goes without saying. So, everyone was expected to show up in mass. So, there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of offensive 1920 differences, but this kind of feels like the modern day Halloween, and it's one of the first articles written back in 1920 about it. So there you go. There's a little history of what it is. But this article goes on to describe, you know, not only different things to wear, other things. There's lion and the donkey you can dress up as. They have all these costume ideas, a lot of cowboy things as well. So it's fascinating. And the University of Michigan did a great job digitizing all the ladies' journals, by the way, for the first 50 years of its existence. So if you're one of those people who loves to dig into history, this thing is for you. I want to hear the trick-or-treat report, 312-981-7200. Let us know if the trick-or-treaters are out. And we're going to talk a little bit about college athletes and the bill and all that sort of stuff coming up on Extension 720. 331 texted in that Topsy, a character from the book and play Uncle Tom's Cabin. I wish I had Googled that before I started reading that description. There's a couple like that in that old article. 773, living in the city, only had two trick-or-treaters. 847, Wheeling, only had zero trick-or-treaters. Come on, people. This is Extension 720. John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman till 10 o'clock tonight. I want to get those trick-or-treating reports, and they're filtering in via text. You can text in 2312-981-7200. McHenry, trick-or-treating about done up here, but the kids who are out tonight will have bragging rights for the rest of their lives, as in, you think this is bad, you should have seen Halloween 2019. Yeah, they can tell their kids about when we were kids. It snowed that one time, and they've got the story to tell it. 847, given the weather, we've actually had decent traffic in Wheeling. Okay, we had one Wheeling texter say not too much, and they say lots of coats worn over costumes. Trick-or-treating comes once a year. Go get it. Amen. Come on, kids. Island Lake chimes into the 847. Had about 100 kids. Some are saying Merry Christmas. Very cute. I like that. All right, 312-91-7200. We'd love to hear more about how trick-or-treating is going. We got Representative Chris Welch on the line. I know we're going to talk about NCAA things. Chris, you do any trick-or-treating, anything through the neighborhood tonight?
Hey, I just made it out of the haunted house at Maywood Park District just in time for your call.
Hopefully you didn't have to dodge any shady characters out of the haunted house, knock a clown in the face or something to get on the call.
It was pretty good, but my two had a really good time.
I really enjoyed our chat that we had, it was probably about a month or so ago now, about the bill that you proposed, and that Governor Pritzker eventually kind of lended his support behind the idea of athletes being able to earn money on their endorsement, and then boom comes this headline I see that the NCAA is for similar things, at least that's what it seemed like on the headlines, digging deeper, maybe not so much. Your reaction to the NCAA and what they've come up with?
Well, I want to thank the NCAA for finally coming out and admitting that they're a $1 billion industry and they've been exploiting student athletes for decades. That's what they did, because what they did the other day was just a publicity stunt. It completely lacked any substance, and it's not a coincidence that it was 3 hours after I ran my bill in committee that morning. They've been watching what's going on in these states. They know what's going on in these states, and they know they have to address it. So they tried that publicity stunt. But I'm glad my colleagues saw right through it, and we passed this thing out of the House yesterday, and it's on to the Senate.
When you say publicity stunt, what do you mean? Was it meant to slow down efforts? Was it just, we're going to get to this eventually? Here's a tentative plan. I haven't really read through all the details. It's been a busy week. Walk us through how you feel what it is.
Oh, John, make no mistake about it. The NCAA has got a bottomless pit of money, and they heard about what was going on in Illinois when this bill was up in committee on Tuesday morning, and they knew that once another domino fell, other dominoes would fall. So they tried this publicity stunt. The Board of Governors merely recommended that they begin the process of changing their rules to allow athletes to profit off their name, likeness, and image. And they recommended that the committee get something to them by 2021. That's all it was. But then when you saw the headlines, it was like NCAA wants athletes to profit off their name, likeness, and image, like it was a done deal. And nothing was done other than say, hey, let's begin the process. Basically to tell the states, hey, back off. We're beginning the process. Wait for 2 years and see what we do. And the only reason they're doing anything is because of the pressure that the states are putting on them. And so it was important that we continue. And it's not a coincidence that we wake up this morning and you see headlines in Wisconsin. You hear about what's going on in South Carolina, New York, and New Jersey. The NCAA is going to come to their knees. They blink, and we're going to bring them to their knees.
See, when I saw the NCAA had done this, or what I thought it was supposed to be, I thought, oh my God, I was blown away that the NCAA did something correct for once. And of course, as we dig deeper, maybe not so much. So full steam ahead on the bill here in Illinois, passing the House.
Absolutely. It passed the House, overwhelming bipartisan majority, 86 to 25. Really proud of my colleagues. We had a great debate on the floor yesterday. And this thing's over in the Senate. And I fully expect when we get back from the little short break for the second week of veto session, November 12th, that it'll pass the Senate and get on the governor's desk and he'll sign it. Because he enthusiastically endorsed this thing, John. He is a big supporter of student athletes being able to profit off their own name, likeness, and image.
So I had seen, I don't know if it was before the NCAA ruling or after, that some Illinois House Republicans were against the bill, which is kind of baffling to me. The party that is for making as much money as one can and saving it and hiding it away and doing whatever you can with it. I was shocked that they had any problem with people earning. Was there bipartisan support for your bill when it passed? What's your response to people that just don't seem to get it?
Well, you know, people ask good questions. They raise some good concerns. You know, the effective date on the California bill, our bill is 2023. And I think part of that is you do want to address people's concerns. But I was a little bothered by what happened in committee because it did come out on partisan lines, 9-6. Only the Democrats supported it in committee, and the Republicans were all against. And I will tell you, I think the NCAA's decision 3 hours later is what really helped turn this thing, because many of those same people that voted no in committee actually voted yes when it was on the floor. Hmm. And the arguments weren't very that much different on the floor. And so I think the NCAA's admission publicly in their PR stunt that this was the right thing to do and that it was long overdue helped me in the end result. But, you know, I believe that the final count was 16 Republicans joined 70 Democrats. There were a few Republicans that didn't. And I was surprised by those that support that are from college towns mm-hmm. that voted no.
Champaign Urbana?
They just don't. No, Champaign's representative was a solid supporter. They're very vocal. But Carbondale, Macomb,
Western.
Those jumped out at me. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And I guess I can't ask you to get in their heads because you don't agree with them. I don't either. I just, in no argument that I see. People have legitimate concern. I shouldn't blanket statement that no one, you know, that they, I don't get what their side is, but I just don't see what the big deal is. The only argument I hear are these sort of, this is the way it's done, they should be grateful of scholarships. And those can all be true things. This has been the way things have always been done. Doesn't mean if we did laws like that, then nothing would have changed ever. And that, you know, I earned an academic scholarship at the University of Illinois for 2 years. It was wonderful. Helped us paid through college and leave college with very little student loan debt. But I was still able to get a job. So I still was able to work and earn money at college to help pay for those everyday expenses. How is that any different than an athlete, except the athletes don't have time to get jobs? It just makes no sense to me.
Well, the thing I tried to explain to the representatives from Carbondale area and the Macomb area, those areas are struggling. I used to be a part of the higher education working group and chair of the higher education committee and spent a lot of time visiting our college towns, and those areas are struggling. Those regional universities can use a boost, and being able to have an athlete go and support a small mom and pop restaurant or support the local sporting goods store, that would help lift up those area economies. And why you would not even at least give that a chance, that boggles my mind.
Yeah.
But as I said on the floor yesterday, I respect their decisions to vote no, but I got to tell you, when you hit with all of the information, I didn't see any downside to supporting this initiative.
Yeah, well, that's a very political answer for you. You're very nice to your colleagues over there. I can just spew whatever I want here on these radio waves, and I'll be happy to do it. And, you know, it's interesting because I think when people hear, oh, the athletes are going to make endorsement deals, your mind goes to where pro athletes do it, the big ones, the big endorsement deals. So I think a lot of people think, well, this is going to really affect so few athletes, only the cream of the cream of the crop. But it's interesting the point you bring up about Macomb, Carbondale, Southern Illinois, some of these smaller schools, even like Division III schools, Augustana out in Rock Island, you know, they got a loyal following of football teams. HBCUs in these towns that really rally get a lot of strong local support. I didn't even think about that mom and pop car dealership, whatever it might be, the restaurant. It may not be the millions of dollars, but it's something that can get you through and really kind of help build a community and a connection between athletes, their programs, and the community.
And one of the things that we spent the last 2 days trying to educate folks on is that I've spoken to probably over 100 agents between California, New York, Washington, D.C., since we filed this thing September 30th. And they have emphasized that the norm will more than likely be signing up entire teams that's going to share the wealth. It's going to be the exception that those superstar athletes who get the big deals. Those are going to be the rarities. You don't have a Zion Williamson every day. You don't have a Michael Jordan and a LeBron James every day. So they're going to take a team like the Loyola Ramblin' men's basketball team that did the Final Four in 2018. None of those kids were superstars, but they were a heck of a team. And agents would go in there and say, hey, we want to sign all of you guys up. And just think about all of the merchandising, that $300 million plus merchandising the university got from that. How much of that could have gone to that team had they been allowed to go out and sign up and make money off it? Could have been money that they could put in a bank for grad school.
Yeah. I want to know, so what does the calendar look like in terms of this getting through the Senate, and when will it be signed, at least in your, if you had to guess?
Well, it's over in the Senate now, and they reconvene on November 12th. So it'll likely go to committee either the afternoon of the 12th or the very early morning on the 13th, and hit the Senate either the 13th or the morning of the 14th. And I have no reason to believe it'll fail. I think it's going to pass overwhelmingly and be on the governor's desk the 14th or 15th.
Wow, that's pretty quick. So then we're talking about this going into effect. I'm sure there'll be a date of effect that it goes into. I mean, we're talking about for next season stuff, right?
Well, the effective date that we wrote in the bill mirrors California,
okay.
And that's January 1, 2023.
Okay.
Anticipating legal challenges. Honestly, the real solution to this, John, is a national solution. And so
yes.
what you're hoping and what many of the states are doing is putting in these long effective dates so that either Congress acts and or the NCAA acts and does the right thing on that level. If not, we've given 50 states enough time to join the bandwagon and get on board. And it's happening because every day more states are filing legislation. You hear Missouri's got some legislators about to file the same thing when they come back in January. Wisconsin this morning announced that they're about to do it.
Well, the Badgers don't want to lose to Illinois again. That's all I'm saying.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I'm happy with a national solution. I think that's hopefully where we're going. And even if the NCAA did do a publicity stunt, hopefully by more and more legislatures ignoring it and putting pressure on, they will eventually make the right decision. My only regret is I really liked it when it was just Illinois and California. I was like, all right, we're going to really recruit. My alma mater, Illinois, could use some help on the basketball side and the football side. I was really hoping for it. Hey, still might be the case, I guess. But I think that what you're going to see is these other state legislatures being like, well, we can't fall behind on this, and I think we really do have a national movement. Certainly, at the very least, it's really jump-started this conversation.
Absolutely. I think we do have a national movement. I think this is real. These rights to these athletes are long overdue, and I think it's about to happen. I think the NCAA is going to be forced to do the right thing, finally, and I equate it to the civil rights movement, and these rights are long overdue, and it's about to happen.
Are you ever going to get to a point where you push for student athletes getting paid for just being a student athlete, meaning their hours for practice and play at minimum wage? Are you looking to this one step at a time? Is that a desire of yours, or you're just looking at the endorsements for now?
You know, that's definitely a lot more complicated of an issue because you got to do it right. You got to make sure men and women are treated fairly and equally. You don't want to create a system of inequities. So I definitely am interested in it. That was just going to take a lot more research and time to do it right. And I know there's an appetite to do the same thing across the country.
All right, Representative Welch, thanks so much for breaking this all down for us. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, John.
All right. And we'll get your text. We got a lot of texts coming in, too. Some people on the, no surprise, opposite side of where I am. I'm used to that. And I'd love for you guys to share your thoughts. 312-981-7200. Even if I can't believe it, I'm sure you guys got some opinions, and I'd love to hear them. Join the conversation. 312-981-7200. Also, I want to know how the trick-or-treating is going, even with the bad weather. Are people doing it? We got a lot of texts on that, and we'd love more on Extension 720. Extension 720, John Hansen for Justin. Dustin Kaufman. I'll get back to the college athlete thing in 1 second, but something we can all agree about, the trick-or-treaters. Yay, we've got some still some hotbed of activity going on in the trick-or-treating world. I got a report from Orland Park that we've got trick-or-treating actually stronger this year than in previous years, and they sent along some pictures, and apparently one family set up a petting zoo in front of their house, a petting zoo in the snow. I hope they got their paperwork done with that. I don't know if that's something they need to do. We got near Midway Airport a report from folks about 150 to 200 kids, 40 vampire fangs, 40 gummy pizzas, 30 Halloween tattoos, 90 Rice Krispie treats, 80 Mott's fruits gummies, gave 1 to 2 pieces per kid. Now, those fruit gummies, I like those now, but when you got a bag of fruit gummies as a kid, it's the same thing as candy. Something about it made it feel like I was having something healthy. I didn't like it.
So is this? So she's giving out treats and a prize?
It seems like it. Yeah, because the vampire fangs aren't edible. And neither are the tattoos, obviously. So yeah, it looks like, yeah, it's like a whole interactive experience. Yeah. I like that. If someone's hardy enough to come out in this weather, yeah, give them a little prize too. Elgin had lots of kids bundled up in snow gear. They were saying Merry Halloween. Hyde Park here, we're about 200 so far. The street is still active. Okay. All right, so get those reports in. I'm just curious, what is the big costume this year that you're seeing from the kids? Maybe it's just bundled up child number one is the big one this year. Have you seen any Chance the Snapper? It's probably a little bit more prevalent in the city than the suburbs. Well, it was a big story all over the place. 312-981-7200. Join the conversation now or later, which is also a candy name, but we're going to continue talking about it all show long. I'd love to get those reports in. You can feel free to call as well. 312-981-7200. I'm just so curious because it was such a big thing. I remember cruddy weather years too. Not this much snow, but I remember like a rainy Halloween and then maybe you'd only do the cul-de-sac and down one street. But I remember every year you knew who was going to have the good stuff. You knew that house that if you got there early enough, they had the king-size bars, but only so many of them. Then they went to the little ones. You knew you had the house that gave away like those pennies that you'd have to give to, what am I thinking of? One of the charities, they'd roll up all these pennies. They'd look like chocolate candies. You get like maybe a little candy, and then you'd give them to UNICEF. And they'd be like, here's a little candy. Maybe this is just my neighbors that did it. Here's candy for you, but here's a little pocket change to donate to UNICEF, which I thought was sweet. Just remember to put the correct one in your mouth and donate the correct one, too. I don't know, did you have any favorite houses you remember? Did you do a lot of trick-or-treating as a kid?
Yeah.
You just knew who had the good
stuff. Exactly, you know.
Oh.
After, you know, it takes one time, and then you go back to that house until the well is dry.
Yeah. We had a dentist. 18. We had a dentist. I know. And he wouldn't give away candy. We all got toothbrushes.
That guy.
And a little crest. I mean, I get it, but you'd think that would help his business. Just kept on just feeding the local kids.
Yeah, every day.
Yes, here, just open your mouth. I got a giant pixie stick. I'm just going to load it down. And yeah, come here tomorrow, November 1st, November 2nd. And here's an appointment card for next opening I've got. I won't say his name out loud. So get those reports on it. I'm just going to wrap up quickly here on the college athlete thing because I really it does boggle the mind, but I know there's a lot of people out there that don't feel like college athletes deserve to earn money. Got one text from the 217, which I don't know if that person lives in Champaign-Urbana or the 217 area code is down that away, but it's also Springfield in some areas too. Maybe they live in Chicago. I don't know, but they say, so now college athletes are professionals, not amateurs, correct? This privilege will be used mostly in football and basketball. Athletes aren't entitled to anything. And I just don't know what that means. What do you mean they're not entitled to anything? They get their scholarship, which is great. Don't get me wrong. If they're a scholarship athlete, awesome. They get a free education. That's great. They also give scholarships to academics and other things too, but that's without a doubt cool. But the school literally makes millions and millions of dollars, and the leagues and the coaches and everyone else on what they are doing, and then other people, you know, use their likeness or things about them. Why not give them? Why aren't they entitled to make a little bit for themselves as well? A lot of these kids come from poor neighborhoods. They don't have a lot of money to go with to college. There's a lot of things that you have to expense. Maybe they want to send some money home back to their family that helped them get to this point. Maybe they want to save it for grad school.
I thought you made a great point. You had a scholarship,
yeah.
Or you know, a partial, whatever.
Partial scholarship. Yes.
So I mean, a lot of people say, like, they're already getting their education for free. Other people get their education for free as well and can get a job to pay for other things.
Right. At the end of the day, why does anyone care? What do you care if an 18-year-old makes $500 from the local car dealership? Who cares? And it just the Republican Democrat thing. Respect to all Republicans out there, no problem. I find myself more down the middle than a lot of my friends and colleagues. But I just don't see how any self-respecting pro-capitalist Republican is against someone earning money that they deserve because of the things they do. Those are my two cents. Love to still hear yours. 312-981-7200. News coming up next on Extension 720. Text from the 757. Why is it okay for scholarship students who aren't athletes to go get side jobs at coffee shops? And it goes on like that. That's certainly my opinion, too. The student athletes definitely deserve it. It's not like it's going to cost the taxpayers anything, because the money they're getting from the people is likely something that they're going to have to pay taxes on. And it's going to be companies, T-shirt companies, stuff like that. And the 773 says, you think toothbrushes are bad? We had a house that gave away plastic rosaries every year. I don't know how many I have in the house. Time for the news in 720. 720 WGN, thank you very much, David. Extension 720. Normally you hear Mr. Justin Kaufman. He's off tonight. John Hansen here. During that news break, I had a nice text exchange with a current student down at SIUC about whether athletes should get paid or not. And the one argument that this, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, I should say, but this person I was chatting with, discussing the idea that a lot of college athletes, and look, I think we see this, and there's certainly stereotypes around that a lot of them, since they're either so busy or basketball, football, or they just don't care about the academics, they're just trying to advance and make it to pro sports, that they kind of skate on by. Well, a lot of folks who are really invested in their careers, they don't get to go for free, and they work really hard, and they're trying to build an education. So yeah, I can see some people being sour, I don't want to say jealous, but sour about the idea that then they get to earn money on top of that too. I could see it. I see where that opinion can kind of come from. Not necessarily one I agree with, because I know a lot of people in academics that are just skating by trying to get that piece of paper so that they can advance their pro career, even if it's not sports along. But anyways, it's a spirited debate. I know that's one that will continue, especially as it goes through the Senate. But we are going to move on and move on to a topic that I imagine a lot of reporters are eager to move on for. Heather Sharone, it's over.
Finally.
The DailyLine.net has been covering it as well as anybody. And Heather, boy, oh boy, it didn't end in this very kumbaya sort of moment at the end.
It definitely did not. It ended with sour faces and recriminations and really bad feeling.
Do previous strikes end, and this isn't necessarily an indication of with that kumbaya moment I talked about, but do they normally end with the mayor and the head of the CTU together announcing things and shaking hands and taking pictures? Is there much to be read in for the fact that they weren't together at all during these announcements?
I think there is. Jesse Sharkey met, he's the president of the teachers union. He met with Lori Lightfoot, the mayor, in her office at City Hall today for almost 2 hours to negotiate sort of this last remaining piece of it, which was how many of the 11 strike days would teachers be compensated for. Typically, when strikes end, that's part of the agreement, to pay them for the strike days so that they don't lose any pay by going on strike. That is not what happened. And late last night, Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, I'm not paying you for any of the strike days, which was why there was no school again today. They reached a compromise. They were going to get paid for 5 days, but there was such bad feelings that Jesse Sharkey declined to stand with the mayor as she announced the deal to reporters at City Hall this afternoon.
Did she claims that she all along said that she wouldn't pay teachers for the days they strike. I don't remember her saying that, but I'm not as intimately involved. Was that a thing going into it that was definitely clearly laid out to the teachers union?
Absolutely. She said it from day one. And the problem is that everybody always says that. Rahm Emanuel said that in 2012. He said that in 2016. This is sort of part of the kabuki theater, if you will, of the strike dance. If you go, you're not going to get paid. And then at the end, of course, everybody gets paid. And that's not what happened this time around. And if you talk to the people around the mayor, they say, look, she said this from the beginning. It's not our fault. They didn't take her seriously. They should have. And I think it's the mayor feels that the union underestimated her and underestimated her resolve, as well as her sincere desire to do what she said she was going to do all along.
Yeah, boy, it seemed to end in a sticky way, and because at some point last night, and I know you were on this very program talking about this sort of stuff, and we thank you again for kind of rejoining and giving us the update. Man, we were close last night. This October 31st date has kind of been circled on a lot of people's minds because there were some changes that would happen to teachers if they were still striking on November 1st in terms of things that they'd have to start paying out of pocket for, right?
If there were no school tomorrow, teachers would have to pay both the whole kit and caboodle for their health care. So both the employer part as well as their own part. And that is a significant amount of money for CTU members. The other thing that was going to happen tomorrow was that Chicago's football teams were going to be disqualified from the state championship race. And that would have affected Simeon, and a lot of people were really upset about that. So those two really sort of pressure points were definitely part of, you know, sort of the behind everybody's thoughts about what was going on.
Yeah, and that's what I guess I'm getting at is that throughout this whole thing, you know, it's kind of seen who's had the upper hand back and forth. You know, you could debate one side or the other for a while. But at the end of the day, I just feel like that date really gave Mayor Lightfoot an advantage to at least put the screws down in terms of, I'm not going to pay you. And that's why they ended up getting only 5 days, is because at the end of the day, you start running down the math and you start figuring it out. Boy, you want to be back at school tomorrow.
Yeah, it was definitely something that, you know, the teachers were very cognizant of. Also, 11 days is a long time to not be at work and to not know when that next paycheck is going to be. So, you know, the sense was, especially since they had reached agreements on the substantive issues in the contracts, it was time for everybody to just sort of, you know, move on. There's also one other little tweak here that I would mention is that under state law, as best we can tell, Chicago would have been required to make up 3 days anyway, because you have to meet a minimum number of days to sort of qualify for state funding.
Right.
So really, the mayor only gave them 2 days. And what happens next, because it feels like it's over. It's not actually over, John. It's never over. Now the deal goes to the rank and file membership, and they have 10 days to ratify this agreement. And normally, when you get to this point, everybody's really happy, but everybody is not really happy because, in addition, this deal will not, you know, they're going to lose 6 days of pay. But it only passed by about 100 votes in the House of Delegates, and those are leaders for each school or each group of schools. So that is not an overwhelming margin. And it's going to be a little bit touch and go, I think, to see whether this deal will actually be ratified. Jesse Sharkey, the president today, said that he didn't think it was a slam dunk, which I think shows you that, you know, this is, you know, not something that, you know, people were, you know, running through the halls of City Hall, tossing confetti, you know, and handing out flowers in joy. That was not the mood at City Hall at all today.
Yeah. So is it a simple majority ratification?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that'll be interesting, especially, you know, you put all the teachers back in the classroom tomorrow and then they go back to school next week again. If I'm a teacher, I find that hard to then say, you know what, let's go through this again. I imagine that's going through their heads as well.
Absolutely.
What have you been hearing, probably more off the record than not, if you have heard anything, from teachers or maybe folks that you know about how they feel about this?
Well, I think there's a lot of bad feelings on both sides. There was a sense that the mayor, you know, was very critical of how the union handled negotiations. She basically accused Jesse Sharkey of not bargaining in good faith, and for several days she had been accusing the union of moving the goalposts. The union basically said that, you know, Lightfoot hasn't been telling the truth and, you know, has been sort of, you know, saying, oh, the city doesn't have this money, and then, of course, finds enough money to make a deal. So there's a lot of really bad feelings on both sides. And if anything, it's very reminiscent of Mayor Emanuel's first term back in 2012. He endured a 7-day strike, and that really set the tone for the rest of his term with the CTU, where he was at loggerheads with them over any number of issues, including school closures and teacher pension payments, and just you name it, they were on opposite sides. And I will be watching very closely to see if this is sort of the worst of it between Lori Lightfoot and the Chicago Teachers Union, or if things just go downhill from here.
One of the poignant quotes that I remember from Jesse Sharkey, I don't remember which night it was, there were so many, but the idea that if candidate Lightfoot was negotiating with the teachers, this would be done already, the progressive candidate that she was. But for me, I'm like, yeah, duh. Like, that's what the difference between, you know, you campaign in poetry, you govern in prose. Like, yeah. I don't know what they expected. And I felt like that was kind of a slight without really, you know, recognizing that, yes, of course you campaign on certain things, but you have to change once you're in charge of the city.
Yeah, I think that is really proves that cliche to be 100% true, because it was a weird strike. The union and the mayor agree on the substance. The schools need more social workers and nurses and librarians, and that teachers were deserving of a pay raise. And they pretty much agreed right away on what that pay raise should be. But they disagreed on how to enforce those requirements. And there was just really a deep, deep lack of trust between the union and the city. And I think part of that is because things were so bad between the union and the city during the Emanuel years. But also, part of it has to be that the union did not campaign for Lori Lightfoot, but they campaigned very hard against her and for Tony Preckwinkle. And I know that Mayor Lori Lightfoot was always asked by reporters, are they doing this to exact political revenge? You know, are they trying to show you that they're a political force to be reckoned with still, even though you won 75% of the vote and every ward in the city? So there were a lot of competing dynamics going around that made it a really complicated problem, and that's why it was 11 days.
Heather, can you hang on for just a little bit longer? I want to take a commercial break, but I'll ask you a couple quick questions. I know you have a life,
sure,
as a mom, as a reporter, and all these other things, and
no,
you're on
life. All strike, all WGN,
yes,
all the time.
Exactly. Well, good. We're glad, and we're not paying you at all. So quick commercial break on Extension 720. Okay, Heather, so the dust hasn't quite settled, as you said, and we have 10 days to see if they ratify this. I don't know how much of the deal is public, how much you guys can look at or what you can surmise from it. It's impossible to say which side won or not, but what did each side get that they wanted out of this deal or not give that they didn't want to give?
So one of the big sticking points was the length of the deal. It's a 5-year deal. CTU wanted a 3-year deal. What happens in 3 years? Oh, you say all of the aldermen and the mayor are back up for re-election? Is that a coincidence? I think not.
Yeah.
So the mayor insisted on a 5-year deal. She got a 5-year deal. The other issue was prep time. And if you can cast your memory all the way back to 2011, Mayor Emanuel made a big push to lengthen the school day. He said the school day was too short and that Chicago's children were being shortchanged, essentially. So they took away prep time for elementary school teachers, about a half hour. And the union tried really hard to get that half hour restored. But Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, no way, not shortening the school day, as they also were not able to get that. So those were probably two of the biggest sticking points. The deal is 41 pages. I will not bore you with all of the details, but it does include enforcement mechanisms to keep classes smaller, and it does include a significant amount of money, almost several million dollars, to eventually assure that there will be a nurse and a social worker in every school. Now, it's not going to happen in all schools right away. The schools with the most need will get the first nurses and the first social workers, and then it will roll out citywide.
So that's the one that I'm curious about, how they kind of codified this, because this was a big sticking point, whether, you know, the mayor didn't want to be handcuffed to future payments and to plans and to not have to adjust on how they manage their school system based on a teacher's contract. What are the mechanisms if the city reneges on their deal, or if they don't allow nurses in every classroom, or if they say, well, we're a little bit short this year?
Well, there are enforcement mechanisms written into the classroom that would trigger fines, and eventually they could even take it to a judge and say, look, the city's not living up to their end of our employment agreement, you know, make them, essentially. Mm-hmm. But included in the deal is money to train and mentor people who now work for the district who want to become nurses or who want to become social workers, as well as money to go out and find nurses and social workers for the district, which is an important part because these jobs are not easy to fill because there's a lot of demand for these in these professions, and the city pays, you know, less than what the private sector does in many cases.
Yeah, so it's more than in good faith, but obviously it would be triggered by going to a judge or something like that. Of course, you don't want to upset the teachers now that you've worked so hard to get this deal. I imagine that it's something that Mayor Lightfoot, I guess I'm speculating here, will do her best to honor those sorts of things.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The last thing she wants to do is sort of to reopen this after it's been so hard fought and so contentious. But the union is excited because this at least sort of puts those promises as they've been pushing for in writing, and it gives them a little bit more certainty as well as ways to address it if it doesn't happen.
I am really bad at sports betting, and I'm also now really bad at anything political betting because, Heather, we talked 2 months ago, and I was so certain there wouldn't be a strike. And then when we came up to the deadline, I was so certain it would be a day or two. Boy, was I wrong. I think I'm not alone in that, but I think there were some people out there, and yourself included, you kind of held me to say, I don't know about that, Mr. John. And boy, this was a long one. And I imagine that it's definitely left some dividing lines. And, you know, we talk about not a kumbaya moment. Boy, this could have some ramifications in terms of how the mayor is seen across the city about her progressive causes that she triumphed during the campaign. I don't know. Maybe some people respect her a little bit more for standing up to the teachers in some respect. I feel like this could be a positive thing or a negative thing, depending on who you ask for the mayor.
Yeah, it's definitely going to play a significant role because now that this is over, she gets to focus all of her attention on filling the $838 million budget deficit before the end of November. So that's going to be some tricky negotiations with aldermen. And I certainly know that there are some aldermen who feel emboldened because they feel like the teachers got the better end of the deal here. And there are some aldermen who sort of say, well, we now know a little bit more about how the mayor negotiates and how she operates because, of course, you know, she's a political rookie. This is the first time she's held elected office. So this gives us a little bit of insight into how to get what we want. So that's going to be a big focus. And it is probably just enough of a preview as she begins to negotiate contracts with the police union and the firefighters union, which are also expired and have been for several years.
What else are you guys working on the Daily Line really quickly that people can kind of look forward to or go check you guys out for?
Well, tomorrow, state legislators will start the process of expelling Luis Arroyo from the Illinois House. He was arrested a week ago on corruption charges. Allegedly, he bribed a state senator. So they will start that process tomorrow. I think a lot of people have been waiting to see whether he would resign. He has not. And we will have some news about mental health services in the county and how the county is moving to change those, which has angered some providers and advocates who say that the changes could hurt patients.
TheDailyLine.net, critical reporting on politics and policy for professionals. I like that. Springfield County and your city stuff. And I love that morning email helps you get up to date.
Oh, thanks, John. I appreciate it.
And last question. I don't know if you were even home or able to see any trick-or-treaters. Did the kids go out as anything?
They did. I outsourced this to my long-suffering husband because it was such a busy day. But my fluffy unicorn and Ginny Weasley from Hogwarts got a huge amount of candy that I should really bring to City Hall and hand out so that I don't eat it all.
That's a good call. Heather Sharon, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Anytime, John Hanson. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Oh, Heather Sharon, thedailyline.net. I'm telling you, Pete, give her a couple days off, okay? I'm going to talk to LF2 for John Williams. Everyone, let's give Heather some time, people. She's all over the airwaves here, and we appreciate that. We're going to take a quick break in a moment. 312-981-7200. I would love to hear how trick-or-treating is going in your neighborhood. What are the costumes that you're seeing? Are kids actually out and about and doing it? Quick commercial break, then the news on Extension 720. Did you say $10,000 for, or 10,000 calories?
Yes,
for
I did.
For that hamburger?
Yes, I did.
Would you try it?
10,000 calories. Hold on, let me dig it.
It weighs
13 pounds. Covered in onion rings, bacon, and mayonnaise.
Take a few bites.
10,000 calories.
I would just kind of eat it over time. I'd just
spend a whole week. Bring about five friends with you.
Yeah, there you go. Split it on up.
Yeah, 2,000 calories each, okay?
All right.
That's a deal.
Sounds good, David. Thanks so much. Our good friend, Mr. Blake Stubbs, joining us on WGN. Blake, I know you'd dive into a 10,000 calorie burger with me.
You better give me at least 6K of that. That's all I'm going to say.
I know we could pony on up over to Murphy's Bar and Grill and have a good old time with that over a couple six-hour span. Blake, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty well. I've been under the weather for the last week, and today is like the first day. You know how, like, when you've been really sick and you miss maybe a day or two of work, and then you go back, you're like, I'm kind of... Then that next day hits, and you're like, I'm back in the zone.
Yeah.
And I feel like everything, that's where I'm at today, and it feels great.
You're feeling great.
Trust me. It's,
Blake Stubbs is a Blockbuster Blake. He's a movie critic, and we go to him for all sorts of things, whether it's current movies or ones in our past. And, you know, the Halloween time, it's Halloween night. Obviously, there's a whole genre dedicated to this scaring the crap out of each other. And some people love that stuff. Some people don't. But, boy, every year there's either these new releases, of course. They up the game and the gore and the scares. But, you know, it's a genre that has been well-tested, I think is getting maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, more respect now than it used to get 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
I would very much agree with you there. And I would say that is a lot to do with the fact that some of the movies that we're probably going to bring up, obviously a big one right off the rip, is going to be Halloween. John Carpenter's Halloween. That's a big one. Everyone's seen it. It's a classic. I actually had it on earlier in the background while I was cooking dinner because, you know, it's Halloween. Why not?
Yeah, a little light fare while you're cooking. Yeah.
Well, I'm a total stooge for tradition. So, you know, tradition is tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's going to be. But when it comes to a thing that I think a lot of people might not understand is that Halloween was really an independent venture where Carpenter really took hold of making that movie. And the spirit of the best type of horror movies out there right now are very similar to that. There are a lot of independent stuff. There are things that get limited theatrical releases, and they get some buzz. But then once they hit either a streaming service or you can buy it and take it home, they find a whole like cult following, and it kind of snowballs from there. And this has been building, I think, over at least the last 10 years for me. And I say this because there's actually some guys I used to work with. John and I met in Champaign, Illinois, when we went to school there. But some guys I worked with right out of college actually started a film production company in Austin, and they have a film coming out soon that's a horror anthology called Scare Package that has generated a lot of buzz. And this is how horror movies really get their audience now. It's not so much a big release like a Saw movie every year like we used to get or something like that. It's sort of a grassroots thing. And I think horror definitely gets more respect now than it ever did because a lot of these filmmakers are taking bigger risks like their forefathers, so to speak, did. And it's paying off.
Yep.
So I think that's excellent.
312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you. What's a movie you like to cuddle up and get scared with on Halloween? And also some maybe ones that, you know, I think we all know some of the ones that we've heard and watched over the years. There's your classics, of course. But maybe ones that you've seen that maybe no one else has out there if they're looking to watch something here tonight, if they're looking to feel a little spooky. So, Blake, I think that's kind of where we'll start off, is the idea being that there's so many movies out there that... Yeah, and look, you're never going to come up with a movie that someone out there hasn't heard of. So if you're listening out in Galena or something, you're like, I've heard of that, Blake, come on. That's fine. We're talking about the general public. I think I'm your prime example. I don't dive too deep into movies. So what are some horror movies, scary movies, thrillers, whatever it might be, that most people haven't heard about?
Well, I always try to venture into the realm of film that most people probably don't seek out immediately, which is really stuff that's made outside the U.S. And there is a film that I thought was very dark. It was very suspenseful, but also the horror was kind of in the audience's mind as well as on the screen. And that's a movie from the guy that directed Old Boy, the original Old Boy. His name is Park Chan-wook or Chan-wook Park. He directed a film called Thirst, which is about a vampiric priest, priest who is a vampire. Yeah, well, he kind of becomes part of a medical experiment, and then it sort of transitions him into being like the living dead, and he needs blood more than he did before. It's very twisted and weird, and it's from South Korea, so you're going to have to watch it with subtitles. The acting in it is excellent. Cinematography is very good. It's twisted. It's definitely going to be something that if you haven't seen it, you might have never heard of it, but maybe you have, because this director has sort of crossed over into American audiences, onto American audience screens before, but this is sort of one of his films that I don't hear talked about as much other than with, like, big horror fans. I think that it's one that is just, it's a really interesting movie from start to finish.
Do you know, is there anywhere you can find it? Is it one of those things you have to kind of go to the, I don't know, do they even exist, like the independent movie theater store or anything, or streaming anywhere or anything like that?
If you have, okay, so this is kind of a roundabout way to say this, but through Amazon Prime, you can stream this, but only if you have like a Starz subscription. But if you're intrigued and you've never had Starz, you can try it for free and watch the movie through that. Mm-hmm. And it's like a 7-day trial. You don't have to pay. I think they'll like attach it to your Amazon account, and if you don't like it, then you can just cancel it. So just know that you don't owe anybody any money, but you could check it out if you wanted, or rent it for like $4 if you don't want to go through that hassle.
312-981-7200, the movie that you love to let scare you or to be frightened by that maybe some people haven't heard of. And we got a text from the 219, a movie I had not heard of, but I just Googled it, called Class of Nuke'em High. Have you ever heard of this, Blake?
I have. That is a trauma film, which means it's the best kind of schlock film, but not like, I mean, I don't know. It's wild. It's gory. It's goofy. It's hypersexual. It's very, very 1980s and hyper low budget. I want to use the phrase hyper low budget. That's all the trauma films. Like, this is from the same studio that came up with the Toxic Avenger. It's very sophomoric might be the word, but Lloyd Kaufman, who is the king of trauma, has made some gems over the year in terms of like having films with cult followings. Class of Nuke'em High, I believe it also had a sequel, and I remember watching it in my dorm in college with my roommate Joe, who John also knows.
Yes.
And we were very shocked while we watched the movie. We laughed a lot, It's meant to try to scare you, but it's kind of in that schlock horror category. Like,
uh-huh.
it very much knows what it is. That's the thing. Like, if you buy into watching this type of movie, it is goofy and out there. And yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it, and I would go along with whoever's recommending it. That, you know, a lot of people out there probably haven't, but you know. I'm going to say go into that one with an open mind.
Okay.
That's the only thing I'm going to say.
We got a text saying, I recommend a movie called Stakeland, Stakeland. I assume that's a vampire one. I don't know. I don't know, Blake, if you've heard of that one.
Well, it came out in 2010. I'm not familiar with this one. This is going to go on the homework list.
Okay.
But apparently it's about a world of vampires, and a expert vampire hunter and his young protege travel towards sanctuary. So I guess it's kind of in that mindset of what The Walking Dead was after for a long time, like a group of survivors trying to get to a place of safety, and like there's just vampires everywhere. That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And you know what? On a Halloween night, that's something I could be into. I think I could get into that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that you always leave here with some homework, which is always the important thing. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Tyke from Country Club Hills. Something that you, Tyke, that you enjoy to get scared by. Which movie is it?
Yeah, there's two movies what you talked about that are very underrated, that no one talks about when it comes to Halloween, especially in horror. And I have two of them. The first one is a very underrated one. It stars Peter Weller from RoboCop. It's called Of Unknown Origin.
Of Unknown Origin.
Of Unknown Origin. I'm a big Peter Weller fan. I have not seen this.
Yeah, he plays a regular man whose family goes away, and he's a regular guy, and he has a giant rat in his house.
Okay. That he knows about. That's kind of his pet, or that is torturing him and terrorizing him.
Yeah, it's making him lose his mind as well.
Oh, that's cool. What's the other one that you were wanted to talk about?
Okay, the second one, this is up there with one of the best horror remakes. It's up there with The Fly, it's up there with The Thing, and it has the word the in it, and no one ever talks about it. But it doesn't get any respect at all like the other horror remakes like I just mentioned. Of course, I'm talking about The Blob. I'm actually watching it right now, The Blob.
The Blob. I've seen The Blob, Blake.
The 1988 remake, I have seen. I remember seeing that. This is going to shock you. I believe this played on television, and it was, like, heavily edited. It might have been, like, a Joe Bob Briggs type thing, you know, when he was doing, like, his horror drive-in movie night thing, I think on, like, TBS back in the late 90s. Maybe I think that ended in the early 2000s. But I have seen that, and, of course, I've seen the original with Steve McQueen in it. So, yeah. So The Blob is – and this one, the 88 version is a much more R-rated gory version than its predecessor. The predecessor sort of wanted to rely on the audience to kind of create their own fear back in an era where you could do a little less and have more from the audience, whereas this movie was a little more overt, I think, in the scares. So, yeah, interesting.
All right, Tyke, you can hit playback on that sort of thing as you continue to listen to us. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Any trick-or-treaters in Country Club Hills?
Yeah, there has been. I was dressed up as a Ghostbuster, and I opened the door for them. They really liked my costume, yes.
So you kind of did a reverse trick-or-treater. You're like, hey, I'm playing in this, too.
Yep, I sure did.
Tyke, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. 312-981-7200 to get those texts in, and let us know if there's – I'm going to drop that. I think I heard him hit play on The Blob there at the end of that phone call. He's like, yep, getting right back to it. Boy, we got a lot of texts in. Massacre at Central High. Have you heard of that one, Blake?
I've not heard of Massacre.
Man, you're getting a lot of homework here tonight, Blake.
Yeah, this is – well, okay, let's be real. Everyone out there listening, I love this. I love when you give me stuff that I haven't heard of. But Massacre at Central High, that's not a trauma film, to my understanding. Unless maybe it is. No, it's not. I've never heard of it. Oh, it was in 76.
Okay.
This has potential, John.
Yeah.
This could be the winner tonight. The thing that once I get off the phone with you, I put on a horror film I've never seen and watch it on Halloween.
Yeah,
interesting.
I'm getting another one that I've never heard of. It's from 2011, Yellow Brick Road, but it's all one word, and it released in 2010. Yeah, have you seen that one or heard of that one?
I have heard of this one. I have not seen it, but I know that it focuses around like something that happened in like the early 40s where people like they just left everything behind and disappeared. And then I guess in like 2008, so in present day, according to when the film was released, like a group of people get together to go and sort of explore what happened and then collide with some force or something, kind of like Blair Witch Project. You know, they went out looking for a thing, and then all this other bad stuff started happening. It's kind of in the vein of that, except it's not a found footage thing. If unless I'm wrong on that, but I don't recall it being a found footage film.
This is the first time you've heard Blockbuster Blake. Maybe every time we do a segment, there's one movie that someone says that he hasn't seen. But, like, we're getting a bunch of them. I'm sure you've seen this next one. Let's go back to the phone lines. Matt in Iowa. Matt, what's yours?
Mine is definitely the greatest horror soundtrack of all time as well, and that is from 1985, Return of the Living Dead.
The Living Dead series.
Oh, yeah. And, well, here's the thing. So I've always been a big Dawn of the Dead fan, right? But I agree with you on the soundtrack for Return of the Dead. I completely agree. That one is one of the big – Return of the Living Dead. That's a big one. And I think that they remade it not too long ago. But you've got to stick to the original one, I believe,
Matt,
if you're going to do it. Absolutely. You got to stick to that.
Matt, a lot of trick-or-treaters out where you live in Iowa tonight?
It's a cold one out here, so we usually get about a dozen to 20 sets of kids. We had three tonight.
Oh, man, did you have all the candy ready for them, too?
We did. Now, like, it was a pretty good haul, though, when we went out with our little one. So, and they got a pretty good haul from us. So those who did brave it, I feel like maybe the kids were a little soft this year. I don't know.
And for sure, exactly. They absolutely were. And I feel that if you were one of the brave ones that went out, you did get that haul. What did the little one dress as, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had it was a Rainbow Dash for us.
Okay.
We had a costume change. We went from Snow White to Rainbow Dash. It was last year as well.
Okay.
And, yeah. Other than that, I can't remember many of the trick-or-treaters.
Exactly. Hey, Matt, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. 720 WGN 312-981-7200. People getting their texts in about which movies they would recommend that you watch on a scary Halloween night. I've never heard of Sisters with Margot Kidder. I don't know that one, Blake. I don't know if you can look that one up during the commercial break, but this is fascinating. You know, again, as we normally talk about these segments, Blake, people have one or two that you haven't heard of, but I think that this is a genre that people love to dive deep, as you were kind of saying, into that indie cult world, and there's so many corners left unturned for some people.
It's very true. I always would tell people, like, horror is always one of the few categories of film or subgenres or genres with a lot of subgenres. It goes very deep, where I know I have friends who, like, that's their favorite thing, and I would always refer to them and be like, hey, what should I watch? Now, that's me who, you know, typically I'm ready with recommendations, like, all the time. This is, we're stepping into an arena that I adore, but I'm not as...
Yeah.
As I guess, like, I wouldn't say I'm lacking being well versed, because I've seen a lot, but it's just a matter of there's so much.
Yeah.
And in the case of Sisters, there's plenty to say about that. So yeah, let's hit it back when we get back from the commercial break.
That sounds good. Everyone's getting some homework tonight here on Extension 720. Okay, we're talking about movies that you love to scare you, but maybe not the traditional ones that we always talk about. The ones that maybe you haven't heard of. We're giving us some homework tonight if you're looking for a new scary movie. Blockbuster Blake joining us on the line, and let's start with Sisters, Blake Stubbs. Someone texted that on in.
Yeah, so Sisters stars the late Margot Kidder, and essentially it's about a Staten Island journalist who kind of witnesses a murder. She witnesses a murder and wants to sort of get behind what took place and how it all happened, because currently the police don't believe anything happened. So there's like a conspiracy element, and she seeks the help of a private detective. The film also stars Charles Durning, and this was directed by Brian De Palma, who also co-wrote the film. And this was in 72. So if you're looking for some peak 70s Brian De Palma, and I know a lot of movie lovers out there always are, Sisters might be the movie you want to pop into the DVD or Blu-ray player, other than Carrie, which is another Brian De Palma big hit around this time of year.
So, yeah, but everyone's heard of that one.
Everybody's heard of that one. Maybe you want the tried and true, but if you want to go a little bit deeper, check out Sisters. That would be the option.
630 says, See No Evil.
Oh, See No Evil. Now, I want to make sure that there isn't another variant that this listener is mentioning, but if this is the version that stars the WWE's Kane, who is a professional wrestler, very large guy, who is essentially blindish or gets blinded and kills a bunch of teenagers in like a haunted house type thing and uses a hook on a chain. He's really big and menacing. They actually made a sequel of it, I believe. So, yeah, See No Evil is one that I would say... okay.
Yeah, there's probably different versions.
Yeah, they're probably referring to the Mia Farrow film.
Okay.
Which was made in 71. In which case, I would say, yes, that's directed by Richard Fleischer. Very much worth your time. Yeah. I wanted to make sure. I was like, wait a minute, there's another film that I'm sure this listener is mentioning. What? And I think that when we don't have, like, an iconic, you know, slasher villain, you know, in some of these films, like, they kind of become lesser known.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you find out about them and watch them, and you're like, wow, this is a way better movie than some of the other stuff I might have picked. And Mia Farrow, you can't really go wrong, I think, with her, especially in the 70s.
815 says, Sleepaway Camp.
Sleepaway Camp. Now, that one falls into one of the more simple-style horror pitches. This was in the early 80s. It's a bunch of teenagers getting killed at a camp. And they had a sequel film, Sleepaway Camp 2. Pretty schlocky.
Wait, what happens in 2? What's the twist on 2 that makes it so different from 1?
Well, I don't want to spoil it, but if I haven't differentiated correctly in my mind, because I have seen both, one of them is actually one of the campers who's losing her mind. and is killing people, and I believe that's in two. So the first one's kind of, I don't remember it as much. I didn't seem to enjoy the entertainment value of it as much as two, but two's a little bonkers. It's a little wild, and very much that 80s schlock horror that I think definitely is great to watch at parties, I guess would be the way to say it. Like if you had a bunch of friends over and you're like, let's watch something that's quote unquote bad, but we know we're going to enjoy it.
What about
that's where I would put those.
We got about 30 seconds left. Silver Bullet.
Sure. Silver Bullet. So the Stephen King story that was turned into a film that I don't think Stephen King likes too much, that stars Gary Busey, about a werewolf that is terrorizing a town and a young boy who is in a wheelchair, an electric one that is built like a silver bullet. They have to find a way to kill this werewolf, and turns out the werewolf is one of the townspeople, a very specific person. I don't want to spoil it.
Right.
It stars Gary Busey.
Yeah, so there, that's all you need to know.
It's in the 80s, I believe, late 80s or mid 80s. I remember seeing that one on television for sure.
Yeah.
And then watching like the unedited version of it, being like, I don't know that I was entertained by either one.
Yeah, for sure.
If I'm being quite honest with you.
All right, Blake, we got to let you go. Blockbuster Blake got some homework. You got some homework too. He joins us a bunch and he'll join us again next Friday. But for now, Extension 720 rolls on with a break and then the news. Thank you very much, David. Extension 720, John Hansen in for Justin Kaufman until 10 o'clock in the evening. Now, David, I know you took the headphones off. I just wanted to ask you, were you much of a trick-or-treater growing up? Were you a costume guy?
Yeah, for a while as a kid, but after that,
Well, right. I mean, you would go the door to the door.
After junior high school, I think it was kind of like, can't be bothered.
Can't be bothered. It's
like, nah, not for me.
Yeah.
And it's a great holiday for kids,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes I think adults ruin it.
as adults tend to do. No,
I mean, when you've got a sexy Mr. Rogers costume, have you seen that?
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, there's something wrong, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the sexy nurse, the sexy doctor, the sexy school teacher, the sexy police officer. Really?
Yeah.
Well, come on.
I guess it's, for the adult parties.
Yeah, I vote yes for sexy all of them.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Pete.
Well, this leads into Yay or Nay, which is a game we like to play here. But I want to get other folks involved in this, too. I list off some stories that are in the news or news recently really quickly, and it's really simple. Everybody wins. Every opinion is valued, yay or nay. So I've actually got two prizes here I want to give away. 312-981-7200. Again, there's no way to lose this game because everyone can have whatever opinion you want on it. But I'd love to get a couple callers in. One of the prizes, a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnatis.com. And I've also got a desktop indoor weather station brought to you by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men. Visit AmericanWeathermakers.com. 312-981-7200. I read a few stories. You tell me yay or nay. We all vote on what it might be. I'll give a few examples here to get the get everyone primed up on this sort of thing. And I see, David, you're ready to play on, too. So new studies show that most people just show up to work sick. I don't think that's much of a surprise to anyone, something doctors have been telling us not to do for years, heading to work when we're sick. But a new survey from AccountTemps has revealed that 9 out of 10 professionals have admitted going to the office with cold or flu symptoms. A third of all professionals said that they go to work when they are sick, and people who are 25 to 40 years old are the most likely to go to work routinely while they are sick. David Jennings.
Yay.
You go to work sick, you go for it, or...
I would agree with those study results.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of us don't have...
I mean, come on. How many times haven't you gone to work and seen someone you work with, and it's like, ooh,
yeah, what are
let
you
me
doing?
Stay away from you today. Anybody got those sterile wipes?
Yeah, exactly.
Let me wipe down that lavalier microphone before I put it on my jacket, you know?
I was going to say the microphone, certainly in our business. Pete, you going to work sick, or you brave, and you're saying, no, I'm staying home?
I've never taken a sick day in my entire radio career.
Are you kidding me?
How long have you been in radio?
Since the late 90s.
Never
okay.
taken a sick day.
And I think I have been sick during that
period. I mean,
you
had to have been sick.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you take your vacation time, obviously, what's allotted to you.
Yes.
You've never once called the boss and said, I can't come in today.
Nope.
I have.
Yeah.
I have no qualms doing it.
Well, yeah, you shouldn't if you're sick, really, but I get it, especially in our business. And look, a lot of people out there don't have the sick days, the paid sick days, so I totally understand that. But boy, if you can stay home. I was priding myself. I've almost gone a year, and here I am raising my chest up thinking I've gone a year without a sick day, and here you are.
I pride myself on infecting hundreds and hundreds of other radio people.
Let's get some friends on the air as well. We're getting to David. David, you're on 720 WGN. How you doing, David?
Good. How are you?
Good. Where are you calling from tonight?
Kenosha.
Kenosha. How much snow did you get up there?
I would say 4 to 5 inches, maybe.
Yeah, pretty widespread. Any trick-or-treaters through the Kenosha area?
No, they postponed it till Saturday.
Oh, see, that was smart. That's what one of the callers said they wish they did in one of our suburbs of Cary, saying postpone it. There you go. Well, that'll be November trick-or-treating, but probably the best call. So you're going to play yay or nay. It's really simple. We just want your opinion, David. Yay or nay, do you show up for work sick? Do you brave through it, or do you have no problem calling in sick?
I have no problem calling in sick.
All right. There you go. You do anything that so you can easily find, they can find a replacement, no problems there?
Yes, but I also feel like I need to get better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, so yay to calling in sick. I just hung up on him. David, call on back from Kenosha. I hung up on him to get Jim from North Aurora on. Jim, how are you doing? You call in sick to work when you feel under the weather?
Well, if it's real bad, I don't want to get anyone else sick.
Amen to that. Amen. So you have no problem doing it. So
yay today. Yeah.
Yay to that. Thank you very much, Jim. We appreciate the phone call. 312-981-7200. Yay or nay. Going to give out some prizes a little bit later on. Okay. Are there too many streaming services? A new consumer study finds that most people believe there's too many choices now. It's too expensive to keep up, especially with the addition of Disney Plus and all this sort of thing. And soon we're going to be getting some more. So according to the study, 70% of consumers believe there are too many services available. 87% they were worried that it will become too expensive to keep up. David Jennings, are there too many streaming services?
There are about to be.
Yeah.
I think we got Disney.
Yeah.
We have Apple Plus.
Mm-hmm.
HBO Plus is coming next year.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you've already got Netflix
mm-hmm.
and Hulu and Amazon Prime, and they all charge a monthly fee. And you'd thought just for a minute, just maybe you were going to get a break.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, okay, this service has these channels. This service has those channels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah.
Too many.
Yeah, it's getting out of hand again.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Is like when it was just Netflix and Hulu, I felt like you could choose one or the other and manage it. But now with all those streaming things, I'm going with a yay as well. I choose Netflix, so we do the cheaper option of Hulu just to save a little bit of money there. But boy, oh boy, there are so many. So awareness is high. 88% know of Disney, Apple TV. Only 37% of consumers were aware of HBO Max and NBCU's Peacock, which I don't even think we mentioned. At 28%. So they say that people are willing to accept some form of ad-supported model. 44% of people are okay.
You forgot CBS All Access.
Oh, that's right. CBS All and ABC. I don't know if they have a streaming service, but they definitely have stuff online that you
They're launching a streaming service, too.
Years ago, I had a gentleman who had worked in the TV business come by. He was an executive. He came to our college, and he said, in 10 or 15, 20 years, it'll be all these services. You'll buy into a set of things that you'll be able to watch online. You won't watch live TV as much anymore. And we all kind of rolled our eyes. But for once, an executive got it right.
Yeah. And that's a scary thought. It's like the end of free TV.
Yeah. No, certainly is. I know the bunny ears still get you CW26, get old Channel 9 here, of course, as well. Pete, too many streaming services, or are you okay with the streaming, signing up for what you want to stream up for?
Yeah, bring them on. Bring them all on.
You're okay with that?
Yeah.
Sounds good. All right. Amazon is making grocery delivery free for Prime members. This is coming out this week. It's eliminating its fee for grocery delivery in the United States as competition heats up in the rapidly expanding food delivery business. It used to charge folks $15 for a monthly subscription fee for Amazon Fresh online grocery delivery service. 2-hour Whole Food deliveries were free for many Prime customers through the app. And starting earlier this week, grocery delivery from Amazon Fresh, free for Prime members who have gone and previously used the grocery delivery service. I'm someone that still feels like I need to go to the grocery store, touch the melons, touch the produce, take a look at it. I have not bought into the grocery service thing. David Jennings, are you okay letting people deliver your groceries to you?
No.
You got to go to the store?
Well, not that, not just go to the store, but I don't want anybody coming into my house.
Okay.
When I'm not there.
Well, you can go down to the door and get it. I there are some services that bring
the,
it.
The in-home delivery, no thank you.
That bothers you. See, that doesn't bother me at all. They're doing things now where you can actually watch them when they make their deliveries. It kind of records the video. They get one little QR code to scan it. I don't care if people come into my house and drop stuff off. It doesn't bother me.
I'd rather do my own shopping.
Yeah, I do too. Pete, you let people, you're okay with grocery shopping delivery?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you use it or no?
Yeah. Yeah. Whole Foods will deliver right to our deck and leave it right on the front porch.
Produce and everything, cool with it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I prefer, to get, if we can go, but if, it's like Sunday night and you're like, ugh, it's dark, I don't feel like going grocery shopping, let's order something up.
There you go.
Do it.
All right, yay or nay, this woman faked a pregnancy to avoid excess baggage fees. So, many travelers get creative while packing, whether it's sitting on your suitcase to try and get it shut or arriving at the airport wearing three coats. But travel journalist Rebecca Andrews took packing hacks to the new level when she created a fake pregnancy bump out of the clothes and laptop charger that she couldn't fit in her bag. All in an attempt to avoid paying excess baggage fees for overweight luggage.
Yay.
I was just going to say, I got three men here to answer this question.
Yay.
I'd say anything to fight the man when it comes to baggage.
I mean, it for most... the few times that I do fly, and it's not often, but by the time my section gets called in, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who is already on board the plane has put bags up over seats that they're not sitting in.
Mm-hmm.
They're over the seats I'm supposed to sit in.
Right.
And it's like, time out. Where do I get to put my bag?
So you're fine with whatever people can stuff, wherever they can stuff it to get on these planes?
Just be reasonable, okay? I mean, have... Like the thing at the when you go to the amusement park, you have to be this tall to get on the ride.
Mm-hmm.
All right, your bag must fit within this boundary.
Okay.
Period.
Okay.
And you get to bring one on the plane, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
Okay.
You put it right in the bin over where you sit, not four rows back where somebody else is, taking up their space. I mean, come on.
It doesn't take much to wind up David Jennings, I'm learning. Pete, yay or nay?
Yeah, I was like, David, have you ever been to an airport? Americans are not reasonable.
Yes, this is what we do.
We pride ourselves on.
Right.
Yeah, it's a shame.
I can't believe
it's a waste.
Yeah, this person was in Australia. I was worried if they got through TSA. It kind of concerned me what other people would be able to sneak on in. But you got all the way onto the plane with a fake pregnancy bump. I'm going, yay, get whatever you can on these planes. Amen. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break. 312-981-7200. If you just want to play yay or nay, I'm going to give you a Lumalati's gift certificate. We got a few more to get through here on Extension 720. Extension 720 on this Halloween evening, 312-981-7200. Love for you to join the conversation with either yay or nay, going over some local and national stories, and you're going to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Also, trick or treaters outside. I'm assuming that everyone's wound down by about 9:20. I don't think there's anyone ringing the doorbell. Most cities, of course, and municipalities have curfews out there, or at least tell people to get done with their trick-or-treating, probably about 7:30 or 8. But I'm curious. We've had kind of mixed reports. Some people saying lots of trick-or-treaters came on through. Would love to hear what those costumes are, and if the kiddos dressed up, what they dressed up as, besides just someone covered with a bunch of blankets. All right, we're going to do a little bit more yay or nay, where you thumbs up or thumbs down this story. Okay, this is a good one for men here. So a razor brand argues that men aren't the only ones who should grow their mustaches. Okay, so Billy has rewritten everything we've come to know from razor brands. The models have real hair all over their bodies and faces. The models do. They show them in there. So a little fuzz on a woman underneath the nose. So it's just ahead of Movember, which is, of course, coming up tomorrow, where a lot of men grow hair. Usually for what? Testicular awareness, I think, that people do that for. The popular health initiative that lets men grow their mustaches. This company called Billy has released a campaign encouraging women to do the same. co-founder Georgina Gooley, which is a great name. Ooh, Georgina Gooley says, we're on a mission to normalize body hair for all women. Mustaches felt like the perfect next body part because despite the fact that we all have them, no one talks about it, let alone celebrates them. The Billy team chose Movember to release this campaign as a way to push its do what you want with your own body hair agenda forward while simultaneously spreading awareness for a good cause. So, would it concern you at all, yay or nay? Should women grow out mustaches for a good cause? David Jennings.
Well, seeing as how I have a mustache and a goatee, who am I to criticize?
Hey, amen to that. I say, but you don't sound so convinced. It's like you're convincing yourself.
Let's just say it could lead to some interesting interactions, okay? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it certainly could. Pete, what do you think? Women rocking around with mustaches.
Yeah, let's bring it on. Sure.
Okay, we're all very woke here today. All about it. Equality. I don't care. I mean, it personally doesn't bother me in the slightest. I can imagine there's a lot of men out there that might feel different. Women, too. 312-981-7200. Yay or nay, women mustaches. Okay, this is an interesting one. It's an age-old question of every parent. What's the right age for a kid to be left home alone? Well, don't just plan that out, night out quite yet. A 2018 survey of social workers revealed that the majority of those polled believe that leaving children under the age of 12 alone at home amounts to child neglect on the part of parents or guardians. So there's often stories of moms and dads being arrested for their kids left home alone at 8, 9, maybe even 10 years old. But 485 social workers were questioned about leaving a minor home, and they give this a period of 4 hours. So a 12-year-old at home for 4 hours. I don't have any kids. I'm probably not well-equipped to answer that. I'm trying to think of when I was 12. I felt pretty responsible. What, that's 7th, 8th grade, maybe 6th grade? I say yay. I think that's a good time to then start learning to be home alone. Pete, what do you think?
Yeah, 6th grade. I think that was around that 11 or 12. I think that's a...
No problem there. You feel comfortable. Maybe check in every now and then. Call about... Don't need to get a babysitter. I think I was babysitting my older brother when I was 12. He was 14 at the time and was getting lots in trouble, and I was quite the tattletale, so.
And, well, the thing is, too, I was, when I would be left home alone, I would just, get on my Intellivision or something, but now with, computers and social media and YouTube, you got to really be careful about,
what they're getting up to. David Jennings, 12 years old, 4 hours home alone. Is that neglect? It's right on that line.
12 years old, that would be at still elementary school.
Yeah,
right?
But like late. But like, you're like in 7th grade at that point. 6th grade, 8th grade, trying to remember. Yeah, right?
Yeah. No biggie.
I guess it's, it's age is just a number. I guess it's up to each individual parent, of course, to know where that is. But they say 12 is too young. All right, let's take a look at this. This story fascinates me, and I don't know which side of this thing I'm on. A Florida teacher fired for giving zeros to students who didn't turn in their work. She was fired for missing assignments. Her name's Diane Tirado. She was a teacher for many years. She was a 8th grade history teacher at a K-8 school in Florida. She recently gave her students 2 weeks to complete a project, but several students didn't hand it in. Since there was zero work done, she gave them zeros, and she got fired for it. The elementary school had a rule called the no-zero policy. The lowest possible grade that teachers can give students is a 50, even if they didn't turn in anything in. So it's a rule she doesn't agree with, and she was fired for disobeying it. Should she have been fired for giving zeros to her students? David Jennings.
She knew what the rule was.
Mm-hmm. Agree or disagree, right? That's my thing. I think it's stupid. I think
it may not be the right rule, and there's probably a better way to start a conversation with the school district administrators about whether this rule is a good idea or not. But just outright going, I don't care. I'm doing this my way. You kind of.
You asked for it.
Put your hand in the shredder there all by yourself.
I know. It's like, I love principled stands, and they're great, but like losing your gig over it, I don't know. Pete, what do you think? Yay or nay? Should she have done that?
She could do whatever she wants, but right. She has to pay the consequences if she gives a zero and 50 is the lowest. She deserves to be fired.
Yeah, but do you think that should how it should be? I guess the other question is, if you don't turn in any work, shouldn't you get a zero? That's what we did when we were in high school. I remember, and even I remember in college, I remember getting a zero on a paper because it was maybe 2 days late. I was doing all these extracurricular activities, and boy, a big fat zero does a lot. I mean, you're not going to get an A in that class, but it was a good lesson to learn. I think that's an important thing. So, you know, I don't agree with her not, you know, following the rules, but Dave, what do you think? I mean, if you're not turning stuff in, you should be getting a zero.
Or an F either way.
Yeah, I mean, a 50 is an F, and that's what the school said, too. They said it's a good punishment to give them the F, but a zero will prevent them from being able to make up a grade, and, you know, it's really going to hamper them. I don't know. Last one here.
What, is that because they average?
Yeah, they put it. So if you get a zero, then you get 100 on the next one. You're still failing the class.
You're still at
you're at a 50. Then if you get a third one, then you're still at a 66. You're at a D. Then if you get three 100s and a zero, you're still getting a 75%, a C. So it takes so much to make up for a zero as opposed to a 50. You know, you still, you know, punish them. I don't know.
Yeah, there is some. It gives you a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm. At least half-ass it. Turn anything.
Put your name on the paper.
Put your name. Turn something in that will get you a 50.
Right. Book report.
Draw a smiley face. Yes. Something. Yeah. I mean, entertain me.
Yeah. The number of teachers, I bet, that are grading homework, that just put their hands in the air and say, entertain me, people. Come on. Give me an A. 219 says, 50 still failing. Way to go to the teacher. Parents will fault their kids if they don't do their chores at home. I think what they're suggesting is the parents can kind of take care of it. Let the teacher give them a 50. All right, we have time really quickly for one more. Car-free zone should be the future of cities. San Francisco, New York City, limiting cars on certain streets to prioritize other modes of transportation. A lot of bikers moving people along through. I mean, we got the scooters for a little while in Chicago. Do you think Chicago should start to limit the number of streets it has for cars? Can you envision a future in Chicago without cars? David Jennings.
Can I envision parts of the city without cars? Yes.
Okay.
But they're going to have to decide if they want to do it sooner than later, because now it's nuts.
Yeah. I don't know. Pete, what do you think?
So yeah.
You think it'll go?
Yeah.
I drive my car in the city still all the time. Now, part of it's because I work odd hours. I work early in the morning, so I have no problem with my commutes back and forth. But boy, oh boy, I mean, that's one of the things I pride myself in the city, is that we still are a driving city. It's an easy way to get around, but yeah, I don't know. Certain congested areas, I imagine going carless will be fine.
Okay. Have you driven up Michigan Avenue on a Saturday afternoon?
It is the worst. Forget weekdays.
Just on a Saturday, and it's not rush hour.
No, and it's because those pedestrians are, and they got to get through.
No, it's not just the pedestrians. Oh, there's so many cars.
I just don't like when they walk on a green arrow. Okay, we got to take the world's quickest commercial break before the news on Extension 720. Turn those clocks back on a Sunday morning, right? 2 a.m. goes back to 1 a.m. I know that. For the most part now.
If you're up at 2 a.m., good on you.
Yeah. Maybe that'll be my goal.
Yeah.
You know, I used to do overnight traffic reporting when I started out in this business.
And you must have hated spring.
Oh, well, spring I didn't hate because you sprung ahead, so you'd work one less hour.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
the fall is a harder one.
Yeah, because you have to work an extra hour.
Yeah, but then you get the overtime. Well, sometimes. I won't say the name of the company I work for, but I did traffic here on WGN Radio. Proud of it. Way back when. But yeah, we would always be jockeying for that spring one and then try and get the fall one off. Because, man, there's nothing. Doing traffic reporting for 8 hours is one thing overnight. Doing it for nine hours.
It's like, help me, please.
Get
me out of here, please.
No, we love our jobs.
Someone have an accident so I have something to talk about.
Yes, just a light one, though. Just a spin out of the road.
A fender bender.
Fender bender that closes a lane or something, and then IDOT's got to go there. And yeah, exactly, something like that. Interesting Halloween costumes we were talking about. 312-981-7200. Either the most interesting Halloween costume you have seen today, or
I've just seen when someone is at the Arizona's 49ers game.
Okay.
Chewbacca. In the stands.
In the stands.
Yeah.
How did he get through security? They had to have stripped him on down, right? That's a lot of things you could hide in a Chewbacca costume, just saying, in this day and age.
Hey, what can I tell you?
Yeah,
you
know? I guess a Wookiee gets to come in however he wants. That was pretty good, David. Whoa. Where'd you pull that from?
Just did it.
Have you always done that?
No, okay. I once in a
you
great
practiced
while.
Practiced it though. You
no, I didn't.
You didn't just know you had that skill at this exact moment. I mean, that's something you
I just figured I'd give it a shot. It happened to work.
I like it. Well, did you guys hear about Mitt Romney and his secret Twitter account, by the way?
That's too funny.
Yeah, he's been a lurker for all these years since 2011. Before he got the nomination, he would just have this fake Twitter account that he didn't use all that much in terms of interacting with people. He would reply to a few tweets here and there. But he just used it to lurk, and he admitted to it, and it was called Pierre Delecto was the name. That kind of made the rounds last week. Well, his grandson today... Guess what he dressed up for as Halloween? Pierre Delecto. He wore the mustache.
Is he a fictional character?
He's a fictional, yes.
In literature? Who's the...
I don't think there's an actual reference. Is there anything specific? I think it's just a French name. And I think that Mitt Romney speaks some French, and that's why he chose it. But I think it's just... I don't think it's named after anyone. Just a fake person, Pierre Delecto. 312-981-7200 if you happen to have seen anything. We also heard, again, from this teacher, they wanted to correct what they were saying, that the teacher about the 50% thing that they were saying. They've been a teacher for 30 years. And I think that they're saying that 50 is still failing, and they're giving props to the teacher for giving them that zero. I think I had read it the wrong way. Okay, so a couple interesting stories about jobs that you wouldn't expect or changes of jobs. Did you guys talk about, you even talked about this brewery, this pastor who had turned in his robes for a new gig. I don't know if you guys mentioned it, but it's called Burning Bush Brewery. The small church closed in the suburbs, a suburban pastor. Wait, are you telling me that Dustin discovered this one?
No.
Okay.
That's an interesting job,
yes.
Career change.
I just didn't want to do it if he just like talked that. About it yesterday.
No.
Sorry I didn't clear that. Okay, so, yeah, so I agree. So he has always been a brewer, this pastor. He had a small North Riverside church, but it closed down in 2017. You know, parishioners move around, and a lot of suburban churches are struggling to keep membership up in certain areas. So... He formerly led this Presbyterian church, but he decided that, you know, once that closed, beyond circumstances that he could control, he thought he'd give it that second passion that he had and just pour himself into that, quite literally. And it's called Burning Bush Brewery. It's going to be at 4014 North Rockwell in an industrial stretch of North Center. He hopes to open the new brewery and tap room this winter, but they're moving along here pretty quickly. He told this is Block Club Chicago, of course, our great friends over there that reported on this first. He said it had been on that trajectory long before I got there. After the church closed, I thought maybe it was time for me to pour my time into finally opening up my own brewery. It's going to have 6 house beers on tap, including an oatmeal stout, a Belgian double, a pale ale, an IPA, a Mexican-style lager, and some recipes as well, other ones involving basil. So he lives in Skokie, but it'll be in the North Center neighborhood. And he says to have the visibility right on the river, it's going to be great. And I find this interesting because, you know, you think about brewing and the church, and in many ways, they're very connected. I know that a lot of churches even used to, I think some still do, have bars in the basement. I went to a school, one of the Catholic schools on the northwest side. The name that's escaped me. I think it's
aren't there monks
and that's,
that
yep.
that brew mm-hmm. or do wine?
And that's exactly what he said. He said some of the oldest brewers in time were monks. There's always been this religious connotation to it. So he says that I just love that God kind of shows up to speak to him in that way. I think it speaks to everyone, whether they're religious or not. The name of the place, of course, Burning Bush, is an allusion to the story of Moses and the Burning Bush. Also the name to the history of brewing. So in medieval times, religious monks in Europe brewed their own beer. He says that some of the best and oldest beers in the world were made by monks in monasteries. And Martin Luther's wife also brewed beer, which I didn't know. So it's kind of cool to carry on that tradition. He worked with an architect to maintain the brick facade and the industrial aesthetic for the old place. He's got a little, it's not a burning bush, but he's got a cool bush in the background there as well. I don't know. I think it's awesome. And it led me to believe that, you know, we all have these careers that we're dedicated to. Certainly we are. I know a lot of our listeners are too. But like, man, I don't know. What would you do if money wasn't an object? I know it is an object for him, but like, if you had to go on to a second career, I used to do home brewing too, and always thought about trying to open up my own place, but there's so many logistics with doing it. But that's something I would love to do. I don't know. You haven't taken a sick day since the 90s, so you're clearly dedicated to what you're doing, Pete. You ever give it a thought to what you would do if you weren't doing this?
Oh, yeah. I give it a lot of thought every single day. Yeah. So I don't have any skills. That's a thing.
No, come on.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got Uber driver, but I don't like people.
Right. Okay.
You know, so that would be a problem.
That's a wise choice on your part.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Fitness instructor, but I sometimes can't do all the exercises.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
If I had, you know, one job I'd want to do, I don't want to be a baseball umpire. I was an umpire when I was a kid. I love baseball, but I wasn't very good at playing it. And I would say baseball announcer, but that's in the field we're in, so not that. I would love to be an umpire.
Really?
Yeah.
With all the scrutiny now?
That's even better. Bring it on.
No, not, it's not, well, not just the scrutiny. But depending upon what kind of umpiring you're doing or refereeing, it could become physically hazardous to your continued good health.
Yeah, certainly. And they got to be in good shape across all sorts of sports. Although I remember some of the baseball umpires back in the day were not always the most fit. And as a fiddle.
NBA, NFL.
Well, I don't want to do NBA.
NBA, NFL, you're moving the whole game.
Or soccer, too, man.
Soccer.
You're running. Hockey. I mean, you got four
you're moving.
Of yeah. So I don't want to do those, David. I want to be a baseball umpire.
You want to be the guy who just sits at home plate?
Yeah. I want to sit behind there, rule it all, balls and strikes, let those pitch people complain about it.
Uh-huh.
Get those managers come on. I think that'd be fun.
Pete?
Yes, sir.
He's missing a couple of rather important details about home plate, isn't he?
Well, what the collisions? What are you worried about?
Oh, it's amazing where a foul tip can go.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen that. There's protective gear. There's gear for that.
Yet it still hurts.
So I was an umpire when I was 12 or 13, and I did it for a couple years. And I will tell, that was my first job that I ever had. And I will say it was one of the most important jobs to have. Everyone says, you know, you should work in service, and that's without a doubt something that a lot of people do. If that isn't for your kids, and they're not into it, or your grandkids, have them be an umpire. Because you having to deal with adults who are screaming at you, or who are arguing with you, or you have to, like, control a field of people, was probably...
To fight with each other.
Yes. And it's up to you, this little 12-year-old, to manage these things. Gosh, the life lessons I probably learned without even knowing that
the power you got to exercise.
The confidence that it gives you. I was scared. Like, I mean, I remember going to game. I remember begging my parents not to make me umpire that first year. Because it was scary. I mean, you would go up there and the weight of all those decisions are on you, 11, 12 years old. And you got to, you know, every single call, every single pitch. And when you're in that league, there's maybe another umpire out there to help you. But you usually have all the bases you got to do as a kid. And then, parents were ruthless. Yeah, were ruthless.
Do you have an instance that you recall specifically where you called somebody out?
Yes.
And a parent yelled, like, that was a strike.
I can remember two specific ones. I remember once where I called a guy out on three strikes swinging. And a parent, yelled from behind the backstop. She was right there, a mom, saying he foul tipped it. How could you not hear or see that he foul tipped it? And she just would not let it go. It was probably her son that I called out. But it was so embarrassing because I went back and thought, I'm like, oh boy, did he? I don't know. Maybe he did. You'd think he'd hear it on the aluminum bat. And then that one still sits with me, her screeching. The other one.
Did you throw her out?
No. I did throw out one coach once before, but that's because he got a load of spit in my eye unintentionally, but he was bothering me that much. I know. But I remember, I won't say his name.
And you were a 12-year-old?
12, 13, 11, 12, 13, yeah. I mean, I did it probably until I was 14. I did the Pony Leagues. I actually umpired a game up at Miller Park in Milwaukee. I was good. I loved doing it. Once I got over the first couple, games or probably the first year, the second year, I looked forward to it because it really kind of gives you that confidence. But I remember the guy who managed the umpires was, and this is in Downers Grove, was also a coach, which is such a conflict of interest. He wrote our paychecks. It was signed by him, and he was the manager of the black team, meaning the uniformed colors that they wear. You have black, green, red, blue, all that stuff. So He was the manager of the black team. And I always hated managing his games because he was writing our checks. And he ran our umpires. And he wrote all the rules for how we operate. And he was the worst coach in terms of arguing with the umpires. I really think this was what he lived for. This was it. Like, and looking back on it now, what a sad state of affairs for someone, a grown man who runs this umpire league, or runs the umpires, and then has kids in the league and yells at his employees. But every game he would hound him. And he's the only person, he's the one that spit in my eye, the only person I ever kicked out. I kicked my boss out of a Little League baseball game. And he tried to challenge it. And I said, no, you said we could do this, sir. And kicked him out. He still wrote the check for me at the end of the game. $12 for an hour at Dorhoeffer Park over in Downers Grove, Illinois. I'll never forget it. I'll also never forget the game that I really did not want to umpire. This is probably my first year. And we had the rule that if you saw lightning or heard thunder, it was a 30-minute delay. Oh, boy, I kept on hearing it. No one else heard it. I was like, saw a little lightning there, heard a little thunder. We're going to have to hold this off for 30 minutes or so until the game finally, I just called it because I just was not up for it. Sorry, kids. But no, I also once umpired for my younger brother and called him out of the strikes to end the game looking. Oh, he still holds that against me.
Yeah, I would.
But yeah, I'd be, having said all that, well, what are you supposed to do with your brother? You're supposed to call him out. That's what you do. Anywhere close to the zone.
Even if he's not, right?
Yes, exactly. I got to tell you, those 100-degree days, you're watching Little League Baseball, and you know these kids when they're first starting to pitch? I tell you what, you walk two guys, anything you throw is now a strike. That's the new rule. I would tell the batters, I'm like, swing. This kid is trying. Just swing the bat anywhere close. In the dirt, it skipped over the plate. That's a strike. We're not going to wait here all day for this poor pitcher to walk 16 people in a row. Swing the damn bat. That's what you're up there to do.
Isn't that the coach's problem, not yours?
No. That is my problem when an hour game takes two, and it's 101 degrees, and it's game one of three in a row.
Okay.
I said, you were easy to wind up, and here I am. All right.
I'll be quiet now.
312-981-7200. If you weren't doing your job, what job would you do? And I've got a really cool new thing that the state's attorney's office is doing. It has nothing to do with politics. It's just a cool new job for one of our... yes. Oof. Yes, David. Oof. That's your tease. Coming up on Extension. All right, 720. Wrapping up Extension 720 here. John Hansen just for a little bit longer. Pete McMurray coming up next. Just telling you about being an umpire from the pastor who became a brewer. That's what I would do. I'd become an umpire. And Pete doesn't want to do anything else. He says he can't do anything else. We never got David's answer, but he'll have to chime in a little bit later on. Okay, did you hear what the state's attorney is doing, Pete? It's a really cool story, and I'm trying not to find it because I just closed the window. So I'm going to stall for a second. This is what happens behind the scenes sometimes. Okay, so there's a new employee at the state's attorney office, and they had a whole ceremony and a swearing in. And it was really cool because the new employee, the new worker, is a Labrador Retriever. And the dog's name is Hattie. She's a 2-year-old. She's going to be on a very human 9-to-5 schedule. And it's cool. The Associated Press saying she's being asked to work like a dog. They're full of puns throughout this whole article. They were very proud of the things that they wrote here in the AP. Then they're doing what they want the dog to do, Hattie, to do exactly what comes most naturally to her, which is show affection. This is really cool. Her job is to ease the strain of criminal proceedings on young children and those with mental health issues who have been the victims of assault, which is just incredible. She's going to handle up to 200 cases annually. And she is the first emotional support dog. She was actually trained by inmates, partially, which is another cool wrinkle in the story. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox presided over the swearing in. So, of course, Hattie stood on her hind legs over the table and placed her paw across a law book as an oath was administered. I love our furry friend. Do you have any dogs, Pete? Do you have any pets or no?
You must not follow me
on
Instagram.
Oh, you cats. You have cats.
I have many dogs, yes. And many cats.
You have many dogs?
Oh, two dogs.
Two dogs. How many cats?
Right now?
Yeah.
Three.
Three, okay. So, 5 total. I just
unloaded one on G.
Yes. Yes. She was taking pictures. She was supposed to come over for drinks last Friday, and she said, I'm taking care of this. I figured out the new cat situation. I didn't realize that when you had multiple cats in the same place, that they have to, like, get used to each other, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah. you slowly introduce them to each
right.
other?
Yeah.
Okay. Slight pleasantries.
Same with dogs.
Really? Mm-hmm. Are they as, but they're probably not as sensitive as cats, right? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I've never
They had, can be.
Have you had multiple dogs at once ever, David, or no?
Yes. I had two collies.
Wow.
Fortunately, it was mother and son.
Oh, okay.
So that was a lot easier. But, yeah.
So they needed no pets, introduction.
When you've got one pet already in the house and you bring another one in, there's going to be an adjustment period.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everybody gets to get to know each other.
Right.
Who's the alpha? Who's not?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It's like a radio station, sort
and,
of.
And, oh, to answer your other question,
mm-hmm.
train engineer.
You'd be a train engineer?
When I was younger, I thought about that idea. I love trains. Always have.
You could do the whistle yourself with those pipes, David.
No.
Yeah, I love trains growing up, too, but I just kind of like to look at them. But you would actually want to be in that, in the room, and would you wear the hat? Or is that a, you'd be a conductor, right? Or is that the same thing as an engineer?
No, I'd rather be the engineer.
What's the difference? I don't even know.
The guy that drives it.
Okay.
Or the gal that drives it.
What does the conductor do that's different?
The conductor has different responsibilities.
Oh, okay. I always thought they were one and the same. Look at this.
No. So they do different things.
You're well more advanced in this than I am. You clearly, you know. That's what you would want to do. That's cool. We had a text from the 630 saying, if I ever won the Mega Millions, I would quit delivering car parts and I would open my own classic, antique, and exotic auto shop. Repairs, maintenance, and sales. So right now he delivers car parts, but he wants to own his own thing.
Now that would be sweet.
Are you a car guy?
I have fantasies about exotics.
Really?
Oh yeah. I'd love to drive a Lamborghini around.
Oh.
Or a McLaren P1.
Mm-hmm.
Or a Ferrari.
See, I'm not a car guy. I'm fine with my Mazda. If I won $1 million, I would not get a new car, I don't think.
Well, seeing as how I don't own one right now, I did own one once, and trust me, I put like 30,000 miles on it in 2 years.
You own what?
I did own a car.
Oh, okay, you don't own a car now. I thought you were going to say you owned a Lamborghini for a couple of years.
I had a 350Z Roadster.
Wow, I don't even know what that is.
Nissan 350Z.
Okay, there you go.
The Roadster's got the rag top, you know.
Doesn't beat a train, though, David.
Yes, it does. I'm a vanishing breed, because you know what they say the perfect anti-theft device for cars now is?
What's that?
Buy one with a stick.
That's so true. I could never do it in a million years. All right. So just to put a bow on it, I want to thank the state's attorney's office. I think that's just really cool. Anytime, I mean, there's so many kids that are going through so many things. If you've ever been in a courthouse or if you've ever seen the proceedings that happen for some of these younger kids, it is such a horrific experience to go through. They're seeing things that they shouldn't see. They're hearing things that they shouldn't. And anything we can do to ease their burden to help prevent, you know, cyclical sorts of situations where kids continue to go in that, even just a few moments with a dog. What a peaceful way to get through that process. And shout out to the state's attorney's office for getting that one right. Quick break, and then we'll have the news and plenty more coming up on WGN. That'll do it for me. John Hanson in for Justin Kaufman here on Extension 720. You can catch me tomorrow morning and every morning on CW26 for the Jam, a weekday morning, 6 to 8 a.m. I'll be at Cary Grove tomorrow with some school spirit with some of those students as well. You can catch me at home, Blackhawks games, every game in Section 312. Come say hi, doing some of the in-arena entertainment.